From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, a look at a new analysis of second offense marijuana possession arrests in Milwaukee County, a felony in Wisconsin.
Then Voces de la Frontera's annual Day Without Latinos culminates in a protest outside of the Waukesha County Courthouse.
Public safety is about making sure that there are positive relationships with all community members, that everyone feels safe.
Later, our automotive contributor talks about the appeal of very small cars, model cars to be precise.
People have been doing railroads in various scales for years, and the scenery that goes with them. It's kind of creating your own special world in miniature because it's smaller and it's easier to deal with, and you can fill a room or a house with it.
Plus, the author of A Book on Bees talks about how you can turn that book into a beehive. Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. An analysis of felony second offense marijuana possession in Milwaukee County has found a troubling pattern. Of the 95 stops where no other crime was being committed, 86% of the people arrested were African American.
The number is startling in a county where African Americans make up only 25% of the population. Gretchen Schult is the executive director of the Wisconsin Justice Initiative, which conducted the research. Gretchen, thanks so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me.
So what prompted this analysis?
You're talking 2 years ago. I think it was just because data is so hard to come by. And we just wanted to see what was going on. There has been an effort, the state public defender requested in its last budget request that second offense marijuana possession be reduced to a misdemeanor. And it didn't get included in the governor's budget. It has gone nowhere. And we started wondering who got arrested for second offense marijuana. Which second offense possession of any amount is a felony in Wisconsin?
Any amount at all?
Any amount, from 0.01 ounces to, I mean, eventually it comes intent to distribute, but any amount, the most minute amount. We heard one story from a lawyer who told us that the officer scraped a few remnants off a car carpet so the person could get busted for second offense marijuana.
Who is getting arrested for these second offenses?
Black men with car problems north of I-94 in the city of Milwaukee.
Very specific.
Very specific. It's amazing how specific. We did a total for 2015 and 16, and these are cases where second offense marijuana possession is the only charge. We didn't want to litter the background with possession of a weapon charges, you know, fleeing, bail jumping. And these are just second offense. So we've got a total of 95 cases, 89% African American, 9% white, and 2% Hispanic in the city of Milwaukee. Of the 95 cases, 76 were in the city north of I-94.
How do those numbers compare with the makeup of the county in general and the areas where they were arrested?
Certainly where they were arrested were heavily African-American. But in some cases like Wauwatosa, I remember this case very well. The complaint said a man who was African-American was driving westbound on West North Avenue. So the officer ran his registration. And he had an outstanding municipal warrant or something like that. So you wonder what prompted this officer to run a person's registration just because they're driving westbound on North Avenue in Wauwatosa. To me, it kind of smells of driving while black. A lot of the stops were for car problems, you know, non-functioning taillights, parked too far from the curb, tinted windows. One was, well, he was parked at a gas station, and yet he wasn't purchasing gas. How suspicious. Let's roll up and smell marijuana, which is another amazing impact. Milwaukee police have highly, highly trained noses because they are always smelling marijuana in these traffic stops, which leads to a search.
Yeah. So what do they need in order to search, just to be able to smell marijuana?
Yes. There are a few cases where there are consensual searches. One can argue when you're stopped by a cop and they're saying, hey, we want to look through your car, how much that consent that is. And Milwaukee police supposedly have stopped doing consensual searches. But they need very little smell of marijuana. I don't know. How much does 1/10 of an ounce of marijuana smell?
Yeah.
Milwaukee police can smell it.
So when you look at the rationale for why most of these black drivers specifically were stopped versus the white drivers who also had these felony offenses, what was there a difference or were they similar?
I think the real difference is that white drivers weren't stopped. I mean, that to me was the most significant thing. Are we saying that white people don't smoke marijuana? People south of I-94 don't smoke marijuana?
How do these numbers compare with what we know about marijuana smokers in the city of Milwaukee, Milwaukee County? I know there's not probably a lot of hard data, but what we kind of know.
Well, nationally, the rates of use of marijuana among blacks and among whites are pretty similar. There might be a few percentage points different, but it's not reflected in these numbers. I do believe that African-American drivers, because of the high poverty rates in those communities, are more likely to have minor things wrong with their cars. But I think in a lot of other communities in Milwaukee and Milwaukee County, you'll find that as well. But it's still the African-American drivers who are being arrested for second offense marijuana. I mean, I have genuine respect for John Chisholm, but charging these cases is just something I really disagree with him on. We don't need to make felons or create another felony for someone just because 10 years ago they had some other felony. The district attorney does say he doesn't like to make a person's first felony a possession of marijuana felony, but I'm wondering why because someone had a felony 5 or 6 or 7 or 2 years ago, having a joint is a felony today. It doesn't make sense.
Yeah. So we were talking before the interview about kind of steps moving forward. And it seems like there's some, not pending legislation, but some talk of decriminalizing marijuana.
Yes. There was last session introduced in the legislature bills to decriminalize and to legalize cannabis. And they went nowhere. Republicans bottled them up in committee. So we believe, and fortunately John Weishon believes, County Supervisor John Weishon, that people should have a say on it. So he's introduced a resolution calling for an advisory referendum in November on marijuana legalization. With any luck, that will at least start a discussion and let people have a voice in the matter. The legislature obviously doesn't want people to have a voice in the matter, so we're turning to local officials for help and allowing people to speak on this issue.
Gretchen Schulte is the executive director of the Wisconsin Justice Initiative.
This morning in Waukesha, supporters of immigrants' rights are marching to call attention to the role immigrants play in the broader community. Latino residents are being encouraged to not go to work, not go to school, and not buy from big corporations.
Organizers of the Day Without Latinos movement have asked immigrants who own small businesses to close them for the day to emphasize the economic loss that would ensue without Latinos in the community. Organizers talked about their plans at a news conference ahead of that event, and Lake Effect's Claudia Delgadillo has this report.
The march is intended to call attention to the federal 287G program. It would allow Waukesha County Sheriff Eric Severson to train deputies on his force to serve as immigration agents. At Wednesday's news conference, Christine Newman-Ortiz, executive director of the organization Voces de la Frontera, says the act would go against the department's mission of protecting the public.
Public safety is about making sure that there are positive relationships with all community members, that everyone feels safe coming forward and working with local law enforcement. Sheriff Severson said this will not cost the county anything. It will have both an economic cost and a human cost. So this does nothing, absolutely nothing, but bring harm and is a stain. It's a stain on Waukesha. It's a stain on Wisconsin. This program should be abolished.
Carmen de la Paz is the director of Casa de Esperanza, an advocacy group for immigrants in Waukesha. She says she hopes the effort will attract Latinos and non-Latinos alike.
And this is a cause that is affecting everybody, not only our families, not only me. It's affecting the whole community. We need your support.
She says programs like 287G are what separates us and makes the country weaker. We have retrograded backwards so much, Carmen says. Our families have to constantly look over their shoulders to see who is behind them. That same fear is passed down to our children. It's sad. Instead of moving forward, instead of being more united, we are disunited. In a written statement, Waukesha County Sheriff Eric Severson said the 287G program was approved back in December and signed by all parties on March 17th. Corrections staff from the department will start training and certification on June 18th. Severson said, quote, the program focuses on jail custody of illegal aliens and will not affect their patrol operations. He said this jail model will not contemplate in doing sweeps to look for non-criminal illegal aliens. The sheriff said he will continue to have the best interests of the county in mind to protect its citizens. For WUWM, I'm Claudia Delgadillo.
You can find more coverage of immigration both nationally and in Wisconsin at WUWM.com.
A short break now, and when Lake Effect continues, we'll talk with a researcher investigating how what we eat today might impact the health of our brain much later in life. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. On several segments last week, we focused on efforts to prevent lead poisoning in Milwaukee and surrounding communities, especially because of its impact on brain development in children.
The work of another researcher points to how what we consume impacts brain health much later in life. Alzheimer's and other related forms of dementia are increasingly prevalent as people live longer. A lot of attention has been paid to how genetics influence our predisposition to Alzheimer's. But Lisa Moscone says there's one key component of our environment that we are just beginning to connect more strongly to brain health, eating.
Moscone holds doctorates in neuroscience and nuclear medicine and is the author of the new book, Brain Food. We reached her on the line in New York. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
You have been doing brain research for a long time. What first led you to connect the dots between nutrition and cognitive decline?
That's a good question. As you said, I'm a scientist. I'm a neuroscientist, to be precise, and I've been looking into brain health for a really long time, for about 15 years. When I first started, my research was on genetics and DNA and biology in many ways. And then a few years into my research, I noticed a change in the kind of questions that my patients were asking. Usually, the usual question would be, what's going to happen to me if my mom had Alzheimer's, if my dad has Alzheimer's? Is it in my DNA? Is my DNA destiny? But after a little while, the kind of questions that was asked started changing, and it would be more like, okay, I understand that I'm at risk because my mom had Alzheimer's and my dad had Alzheimer's, so what should I eat? And I was unprepared to really answer the question, and so I started to look into that, and I went back to school. You know, there's always time to study more. So I went back to school and I completed another degree in nutrition. And then I started my own lab at NYU Medical to really focus on brain fitness and how diet and lifestyle influences brain aging and that likelihood to age gracefully or develop Alzheimer's disease and dementia instead.
And I gather, I mean, while your particular area of interest, of academic interest, is in Alzheimer's and Alzheimer's prevention, a lot of what you write about can be applied more generally to brain health as well.
Yes, absolutely. I think Alzheimer's is a little bit of the extreme kind of reaction that the brain can have to aging and all the things that we put into our bodies is just not good for the brain in so many ways. You know, for many years we thought of Alzheimer's as the consequence of either aging or bad genes or both. And in a way, we thought of that as inevitable in some ways, whereas now there's more of an understanding that your lifestyle really plays a very big role in what happens to you over time, and not just your risk of Alzheimer's, but really your everyday life, and that the foods you eat really affect the way you think as well as the way you look. But as a society, we tend to focus on the way we look, and we're less aware that we feed our bodies and our brains at the same time.
There is a lot you cover in this book, far too much for us to cover everything thoroughly in 15 minutes or so, but I wanted to ask you about several areas of study in particular that maybe might be misunderstood in terms of the role they play. And one of the big eye-openers for me was the overall importance of water in maintaining the health of your brain. Can you lay out why water is so important and moreover, the kind of water that we're talking about?
Yes, gladly. So the human brain is 80% water, and many people don't realize that. Water cannot be stored in the body. It needs to be continuously replenished, and we need to be able to provide our brains with the right amount of hydration on a daily basis, because the brain is very, very sensitive to dehydration. There is evidence that just very mild dehydration, like a 2 to 4% water loss, can cause neurological symptoms like confusion, brain fog, dizziness, and even brain shrinkage. There are brain imaging studies show that people who are dehydrated literally show brain shrinkage. And you don't want your brain to shrink. It's really not a good thing for you. But it could be reverted completely just by drinking water. So that is incredibly important. And you know, the kind of water the brain needs is called hard water. And that means natural water that is very rich in minerals and electrolytes that promote and sustain hydration. But most people don't drink water. They don't drink enough water. And they drink water that actually has been stripped of all these nutrients, like purified water or seltzer or club soda. That's not the kind of water that your brain needs.
So is tap water then ideal for brain health? You know, there are a lot of people who are concerned about what's in our tap water, but as far as our brains go, should we think twice before we, you know, put that filter on our kitchen faucet?
Yes, of course. There are many options with water filters, and some are very effective, some are less effective. I think in general, filtering water removes some of the nutrients from the water along with other things that you don't want to be drinking. So something that is safe to do if your tap water is not particularly good, for example, and you need really strong filtration systems, is to take a mineral supplement on a daily basis.
The other area that is, I think, somewhat misunderstood that you write a lot about is the importance of fat. How do our brains deal with fat?
This is controversial, and it was very surprising to me when I learned how many people were going on high-fat diets just recently. So from a scientific perspective, the brain contains quite a bit of fat. But most of the fat that is present inside the brain is actually made by the brain itself. So if you think about fat in general, we classify fat as cholesterol. Everybody knows cholesterol is a big kind of fat in our bodies.
Of course.
Saturated fat, right? Yes. Saturated fat, like the kind of fat that you eat in dairy products, are very rich in saturated fat, or in fatty meat, for example. And then there are polyunsaturated fats, like the omega-3 that we find in salmon and in fish. So these are the major kinds of fat, usually. And as far as the brain is concerned, cholesterol from the diet cannot even enter inside the brain. There's a barrier that protects the brain that literally has gates that open and close, letting the nutrients that the brain wants in and kind of closing the gates to everything else. Cholesterol cannot get inside the brain. So whatever cholesterol you eat will never get inside your brain. Saturated fat is also not needed by the brain after adolescence. Pretty much once we're grown-ups, the brain just stops taking it from the bloodstream. And the only kind of fat that the brain really needs is the polyunsaturated one, so like omega-3 and omega-6 fatty acids.
And you write that there's a balance between omega-3s and omega-6s we need to maintain.
Yes, there should be a balance. So research shows that a 2-to-1 ratio is actually a very good one. Two molecules of omega-6 for every molecule of omega-3 is actually a favorable one. But what's been found in the Western diet is that most people consume a ratio of 20-to-1 or 30-to-1. And since omega-6 fatty acids are pro-inflammatory, that means that our diets make us prone to inflammation.
And inflammation has a real impact on brain health, right?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, absolutely. On health, brain, body health, yes. We should try to minimize inflammation in our bodies. Actually, inflammation makes you age faster. So for anybody who's concerned with the future of their brains, we should all try to minimize inflammation and oxidative stress as well, like free radicals in the body and brain.
Now, you've also studied glucose for a long time, and you write that...
Yes, a long time.
Yeah, and you write that it is a vital piece of the puzzle, but it sounds like we should not all run out and buy Snickers bars. There's a specific kind of glucose we're talking about.
Yes, for sure. So the brain pretty much runs on glucose under normal physiological conditions, and that means that about 99% of the energy in the brain is generated from glucose, and glucose is a sugar. I find that can be confusing to people because I'm really not suggesting that we should eat more sugar. So sometimes what is not clear is that there are some kinds of sugar that are gentle on the body and some kinds of sugar that are really very aggressive, like refined sugar, like white sugar. High fructose corn syrup contains a lot of sugar that is just not, the body just has very strong, extreme reactions to that. The kind of glucose that and sugar that the brain needs is actually a kind of gentle sugar. It's found in products that are sweet, but not particularly sweet, like beetroot. Beets are an excellent source of glucose. Onions are a good source of glucose. Scallions are a good source of glucose. And of course, then there are other foods that are sweet, like honey or maple syrup. They contain a good ratio of glucose to other sugars. That the ratio actually favors glucose over other sugars. And these are foods that are helpful to the brain in terms of energy production without affecting our insulin levels.
How resilient is your brain? For someone who has been eating what we think of as the more common Western diet today, if they make these changes and even make these changes over time, how influential can these changes be given that someone may have eaten in a certain way for, 20 or 30 or 40 years?
Yes, that's a really good question. There's evidence from research that it is never too late to adopt a healthy diet. There are very large-scale studies showing that people who change their diet and really start following a healthy diet in midlife, so in their 50s, have a much lower risk of dementia when they get older. So that's already in midlife. Of course, the sooner you start, the better, but it's never too late to start.
Well, Dr. Lisa Mosconi, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Thank you so much for having me. Such a pleasure.
Dr. Lisa Mosconi is the Associate Director of the Alzheimer's Prevention Clinic at Weill Cornell Medical College in New York. She's author of the recent book, Brain Food, The Surprising Science of Eating for Cognitive Power. We reached her on the line from New York City in March.
Our automotive contributors shrink the focus of their attention down to the scale model size. We will talk about model cars instead of car models when Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Joy Powers. We speak with contributor and car writer Mark Savage every month about trends in the automotive industry, from the minutiae like the options available on cars to the bigger picture and issues like fuel economy. But Mark Savage also writes about much smaller cars, model cars, in fact.
He is the author of Kalmbach's Scale Auto Magazine, a bi-monthly magazine devoted to replicas of cars from model kits to die-cast cars that hobbyists customize. Some 20,000 people subscribe to the magazine, which is just turning 40 years old. Our other auto contributor, Dan Harmon, talks this month with Mark about the state of the model automotive industry and the focus of the magazine.
It really is about improving your building skills and, you know, enjoying other people's work, because we do a lot of galleries in there of people around the country. We go to a variety of shows and have representatives of ours at a variety of shows from coast to coast, and, you know, see what other people are doing, inspire yourself, and learn how to make a better-looking car model that looks more realistic.
So I'm old enough, I know it shocks some people, to have been part of the generation that built models from plastic models. You used to go to the hobby store. You could pick up an airplane, which is kind of the things that I built. So it doesn't seem like it's as big of a thing anymore. Is this related to that? I mean, I know this is about cars.
Right. I mean, there are a lot of plastic models still out there. I would say there are not as many hobby shops as there were when probably you and I were kids and others over 40. And it was certainly probably hit its peak in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. But there's a lot of stuff still out there. There's thousands of people who do this. There are shows all over the country where hundreds of people get together and show off their work. And it's, you know, I'd say the majority of people who do this are probably 45 to 65. And mainly because a lot of folks, they get to retirement age or the kids are out of the house and they have some more free time. And it's a good creative activity. It's something that where you can customize, make a car look like you want it to look, as opposed to maybe looking at it exactly realistic or exactly the way you'd see it on the street. But there are people who that's their whole goal. It must looks like it just came out of the showroom. But it's still popular. It's just not as popular as Nintendo or something like that or all of the video games. But you know what we see is a lot of younger couples are trying to get their kids involved in some sort of hands-on activity. And something other than just operating your thumbs all the time. So I think things like this where people build something or make something of their own, I think it will be making a comeback as time goes by. Plus, you know, the kids work with Legos and play with Legos all the time. There are snap kits that you can put together that instead of it looking like a squarish, funny-looking little Lego toy, which is fun, you can make it, snap it together, and it looks just like a real car. So, you know, what's wrong with that? That'd be more fun to me.
And speaking of it looking like a real car, I was looking at your website, and I remember on the front page was a Lincoln, and I actually thought that was a real car. I thought that someone had a classic Lincoln, and you were going to review it, but on further inspection, it was a picture of a model, so it really did look very realistic.
Well, right. I think that one in particular was a die-cast, and that's something else that we've been getting into more recently in the magazine. The magazine started out covering plastic models and die-cast, and then it kind of got away from the die-cast. But that is so popular these days, and there's so many people collecting it that we've started to move back that way. And I think people are interested in filling the slots in their collection. You know, I might be a guy that collects only Lincolns and makes only Lincolns, and that's great. But, hey, I can't get a 1970 Mark III or something, and that's what I really want. So now you can go buy one that's beautifully detailed, or I can get a plastic kit and make it myself and detail it exactly the way I want it.
What is the difference between the two, between plastic models, which I'm sure most of us are familiar with, and then die-cast?
Well, die-cast is, you know, I guess what people probably think of is Hot Wheels and Matchbox toys and stuff like that, and those are the little versions. But the I'd say 1/43rd and 1/24th and 1/18th scale is what people are probably collecting more of these days, and they're like a foot long for the 1/18th scale. And so these are kits that are – you can certainly buy some metal models and make those, but these are pre-made and pre-decorated, if you want to call it that. We'll have all their decals, so all the you know, logos and so forth that might be on a car are already on there. And they're extremely well detailed these days. And anything can go from probably $100 to $500, depending on how much you want to spend. Whereas a plastic model, you can get somewhere between $5 and $50 on a normal model, and probably 20, 25 is a real good average.
So a die cast is a kit as well?
No, it's not really a kit. There are some that are out there that you can build that do have die cast bodies, but the die cast cars are pre-made, pre-decorated, so to speak, and you know, something that you collect and display. A lot of people put them into a plastic, you know, an acrylic case and keep them dust-free and all that good stuff.
Okay, so you mentioned that it's a good thing for kids to get involved, or parents are trying to get their kids involved, which is how I think you and I remember it being something that mostly children did, or you know, younger people. Has that changed? It seems like a lot of what you do is for collectors or older people who are either looking back or for whatever reason want to have a model of a car.
Right. I'd say the people who are building their own are probably more in that 45 to 65 range, because they are guys like us that maybe remember doing it as a kid, or as I said, they have more free time. They can get back to it and have time to put 3 to 4 hours a week maybe into something like that. And then after a month, you've got a really nice looking kit that you can put onto your desktop. Or if you have a display case, some of us do, that's nice to have because you keep the dust off of them. But and then, like I say, I think what we're seeing is that some more kids are going to get involved in this as families try to encourage the kids to make things instead of just play with the electronics.
Has anything changed as far as the construction or the way the kits are put together, and maybe the glue? I remember getting somewhat high on the glue fume. I don't know if there's anything different now about how these go together.
I don't think you're allowed to talk about getting high on a radio, are you? I mean, well, there's still glue to put them together. There's liquid glue that you can use with a brush that's a lot easier, that you can just, it's easier to get it on the model and not have that big glob that I can know, as we all had as kids. You'd put it together, squeeze the parts together, and a big glob of glue would come out, and somehow it'd get on your finger, then it got on the model. The liquid glue is a lot easier, but there's super glue and regular testers' model glue and other people's model glue, Tamiya. So you can still glue them all together, and that is primarily the way they are. But again, there's snap kits that are aimed at the younger folks, probably under 10, that they can just snap the kits together, put them together, and then play with them, because it becomes more of a toy at that point. But you certainly can paint them and fix them up any way you want.
And how do the manufacturers decide what they're going to produce? Is it a popularity contest, or is it a nostalgia thing, or both?
It is a little both. There are a lot of kits that get repurposed. Revell and Round 2 are constantly bringing out kits that maybe were popular back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and then just repurposing that, rebooting it, maybe put some new decals in, maybe replace some of the parts. And then there are newer kits. I know Tamiya just came out with a new Formula One Ferrari that was a Ferrari from last year's racing season. That's very modern and new. And I know Revell is about to come out with a new Ford GT, that like the car that raced at Le Mans and at Daytona. So it's popularity. It's what do you think would be hot. I think when we were kids, you know, I had a model of a 64 Plymouth Valiant because we had a 63 Plymouth Valiant. And you thought, well, that's as close as I can get as a model, and I'll make that. You don't see so many kits of like Toyota Camrys and Honda Accords, because really a lot of those do look pretty much alike. So what's popular is still muscle cars and the Camaros and Corvettes and Mustangs and the exotic cars, the Lamborghinis, things like that.
I would imagine that there's some nostalgia of nostalgia, which would be like a Mini or a Volkswagen Beetle, those kinds of cars, yeah?
Right, the Beetle's still out there. I know there's a Revell snap kit of a Beetle and the Microbus. And yes, some of the nostalgia things, you know, a 32 Ford is still popular because you can turn it into a hot rod. You can turn some of these things into gassers and drag racers and so forth. So there is a lot of nostalgia in this, and I think, you know, anything you might see at a car show, a real, you know, custom car show or an antique car show, you can certainly get that or build that in a plastic model. It just will cost you a little less than if you've been out and got the real thing, and it doesn't take up as much garage space either.
What's different now with the magazine than when it started? I'm sure that some things have changed a lot and some things have probably not changed at all.
Well, right. We've been working on putting together a 35-year DVD so people can have all the back copies. And it's interesting to look back. Of course, obviously, everything was in black and white initially. Now everything's in color in the magazine, which, you know, most magazines are like that. And there was a lot more trucks back in the day, a lot more semis and wreckers and things like that. And while there's still people that do that, I would say that's, you know, down to that 10 or 15% level of people doing the bigger trucks. So it's really more muscle cars, modern cars, racing cars. And we're trying to reflect that in the magazine. We're trying to broaden it out and have a little of everything in there. And again, we go around to all the shows around the country, and you do see a little of everything. Some things are just make-believe cars. People make what they think would look cool, and they piece things together. They scratch-build kits where they may use a body or a chassis out of one plastic kit and then, you know, decide, hey, I'm going to use my own styrene and form it the way I want and build my car the way I want, or a fantasy car of some sort. Almost a concept car of the mind, I guess, here that people come up with instead of something that the auto manufacturers have done.
And just a kind of a weird question, I guess, but how does this fit into the whole world of miniaturization? I mean, it's really not that strange, really. I mean, when you consider dollhouses, or if you go to, I don't know, the fairy castle at the Museum of Science and Industry, which is a really fascinating exhibit. Does this have a kind of a fit, I mean, with that whole kind of world of making things little?
I think a lot of people like to make miniature products of whatever it is, whatever you find interesting. I mean, obviously at Kalmbach we've got model railroaders, so people have been doing railroads in various scales for years and the scenery that goes with them. It's kind of creating your own special world in miniature because it's smaller and it's easier to deal with, and you can, you know, fill a room or a house with it and have some fun along the way. It's all about creativity and doing what you feel moved to do. Some people paint paintings. Some people make miniatures of whether it's dollhouses or railroads or plastic cars, or with our other magazine, Fine Scale Modeler, it's a lot of military vehicles, whether it's aircraft or armor or trucks and tanks, whatever.
Yeah, there's all kinds of things leaping to mind, like miniature trees and miniature Zen gardens. There's no shortage.
Hey, you know, miniature fits everywhere.
Right on. Well, congratulations, Mark, and thank you for coming back on.
Yeah, thanks.
Mark Savage writes the auto review column Savage on Wheels for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and SavageOnWheels.com. He is also editor of the now 40-year-old Scale Auto magazine, part of Kalmbach Publishing in Waukesha. He joins contributor Dan Harmon regularly to talk about cars.
One last break, and then we'll learn about how you can attract bees to your yard, but maybe not the ones you're thinking about. That's when Lake Effect returns on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Joy Powers. There's a lot of talk about the many dangers facing bees in the United States and how important these pollinators are to the environment and agriculture. But when we talk about bees, we tend to focus on just one type, honeybees. In fact, honeybees and other kinds of social bees make up just 2% of the more than 20,000 different types of bees in the world.
A new book for kids is calling attention to some of these lesser-known bees, namely the mason bee. The aptly named Turn This Book Into a Beehive includes 20 different experiments that bring the world of bees to life and invite you to literally turn its pages into a hive for local bees.
Author Lynn Brunel was in Milwaukee for a series of events in the area, and she joined me in studio. Lynn, thanks so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me.
So I think the most astonishing thing first reading your book was just the fact that most bees aren't social.
Yeah, I know. That blew me away, too. Because I think when most people think of bees, they think of honeybees, right? They think of the queen bee, and they all live in a hive, and they make honey, and then if you get too close, they sting you. Well, it turns out only 7 species of the 20,000 species of bees are honeybees.
That's crazy.
Isn't that crazy? But I think it just sort of shows, too, that that's our human interest in them because they produce honey. These other bees, they don't make honey. They're amazing pollinators, and they're going to be, I think, our saviors in the, you know, in the future, but they don't make honey.
So tell me about some of these solitary bees. What kind of bees are considered solitary?
So they're called solitary because they don't live in a hive. The ones that are in a hive that live socially, meaning one queen with all the worker bees, that's social. Solitary, every girl's a queen. And every female is sort of like a single mom. She finds the house, she gets the food, she lays the egg, she builds a wall, she does all that stuff on her own. The solitary bees will live near each other. But not in the same place. Sort of like they like, you know, condos next door to each other. So like when you set up a, when you create a hive for them, like with these tubes that they like, they'll all come in and they'll all live happily near each other. But each tube is belongs to one particular female bee. It's cool.
And those bees are specifically called mason bees.
Mason bees, because they use mud to spackle these walls in between to make these little compartments in the tubes. So a pile of food, lay an egg on the top of the pile of food, and build a wall. Get another pile of food, lay an egg on that, build another wall so that the straw-like container will have, you know, 10 to 12 little compartments, and the egg will eat the food, then create a cocoon around itself and winter over, and then in the spring, chew out of its cocoon, chew out of the mud wall, and fly out and start the whole thing all over again.
Now, this book, turn this book into a beehive, can in fact be turned into a hive, kind
yes.
of, for these mason
yeah.
bees.
Yeah. So I looked up the word hive because I liked the title so much when I was like, oh my gosh, turn this book into a beehive. It's like a transformer. I love it. And then I thought, but I can't say hive because they're not making honey. Well, I looked up the word hive, and hive just means a man-made structure built to house bees. So it totally is a hive.
It completely is a hive,
yeah. But, I mean, again, when we think about it in terms of honeybees are domesticated, right? They were all brought over from Europe. They're not wild. Whereas these solitary bees, they're all wild. They're just wild and roaming free. So when you build a structure for them that looks appealing to them, they will make it their home. Whereas a honeybee hive, those were man-made structures in order to hold honeybees, you know, in order to be able to use their honey and their honeycomb.
Yeah. So there's the mason bee, but then there are a few other types of bees that live in completely different structures.
Oh, yeah. It's amazing. I mean, if you think about it, with 20,000 different species of bees, you know, and only 7 of them honeybees, there are carpenter bees. They like to dig into wood and live in wooden holes. There are miner bees, and they like to dig into the soil. There are leafcutter bees. They live in these sort of tubes, too, these little skinnier versions of the tubes, and they don't dig for mud and make the walls. They actually chew up leaves and make a kind of a paper wall. And there's huge bees. There's, you know, bees the size of your thumb, and then there's bees the size of a fingernail paring. You know, they're all over the place.
I remember a while back I was planting an herb garden, and there were these little black things that were flying around, and a friend of mine was like, those are bees. I said, those can't be bees. And they were coming out of the soil. They were these tiny little guys that were coming out of the soil. What? And when I read your book, I went, oh, those, he was very right. Those were bees.
Those are bees, yeah.
What kind of misconceptions do you get from, and not just adults like me, but the kids who you work with when you're talking to them about these bees?
Yeah. Well, I think the first thing is, you know, my own misconceptions of them before I wrote the book. You know, if I heard a buzzing sound, I was running in the opposite direction. Now I hear a buzzing sound and I'm like, what are you? Where are you going? What are you landing on? One of the, you know, the misconceptions is about identifying, right? So hornets and wasps, yellow jackets, they're kind of a little bit they're going to sting you. They can be aggressive. They're not, you know. So how do you tell the difference between a hornet and a bee and a fly? Because some of the mason bees look like flies, right? And, you know, you don't want to swat them if they're actually doing good for you. So the rule of thumb is, what do they land on, right? If it lands on a flower, like if those bees coming out of the dirt came up and landed on a flower, it's a bee. If it lands on your ham sandwich and starts eating it at a picnic, it's a hornet or a yellow jacket, because they're meat eaters. They eat other bugs. They're carnivores. They're not pollinators. They're meat eaters. And if it's a fly, it's going to land on dog poop, you know? So that's how you can tell by looking at that. But the misconception is that not all bees are striped. Not all bees are going to sting you.
What bees do you, because there's, I think, misconception about, like, well, a bee can only sting you once. You know, its stinger falls off. Mm. And what bees will sting you? Because it's not every bee, every kind of bee of every type. It's only specific bees.
Right. So the bees that will sting you are the honeybees. Honeybees and bumblebees. And the reason they sting you, they're not mean. They're not going after you just to be horrible and aggressive. They're protecting their hive. They have a lot to protect in that hive. The queen is the only organism that's putting out the genetic information for generations to come. So they have to protect her. They're not laying eggs. Only the queen is laying eggs, right? And then the honey. It takes so much time and energy for them to produce this honey. One honeybee can spend its whole life pollinating and gathering nectar, right, to make a teaspoon of honey. That's not a lot. So it's a huge amount of effort. And if you think about the hive with its packed full of honey and a queen bee, they need to have these defense mechanisms in order to protect somebody or something from coming to take that away. So they will sting you. And honeybees, I think, and bumblebees as well, their stingers is kind of they're barbed, right? So they've got downward pointing little spikes. If it goes into your skin, it's not going to come out easy. And if it does come out, usually what happens is that they inject the stinger, and then it's got this little pool of venom at the bottom, and it pulses into you. That's what it stings. That's what hurts, is this venom. And then when they fly off, they leave the stinger in you, and it pretty much rips off the bottom third of their body. So they do die.
Mm.
But yellow jackets and hornets and wasps do not have barbs, so they can sting you over and over and over and over again. But mason bees and a lot of these solitary bees, they may have stingers because the stinger is the same organ that they lay eggs through, too. It's called an ovipositor.
Yeah, so is it just female bees then?
Yeah. Males pretty much do one thing. They wait for the females, they jump on the females, and they mate with them, and then they're done. They don't do anything. Nope, they just, that's it. So all the worker bees in a honeybee hive are female, all of them. And so anatomically, they're the same as the queen, but they don't use their ovipositor to lay eggs at all. They just use them for defense mechanisms and venom. A mason bee has the, you know, can use its ovipositor as a stinger. If you mess with a mason bee, it will sting you in that it'll poke you with its stinger, but it doesn't have any venom in it, and it's not barbed. So you're really not going to feel it. And if you do feel it, what I've heard is that it feels like a mosquito bite. I don't know. I've had them on me, and they've never, ever. I mean, I've never really tried to bug them either, so.
Yeah. I'll say that was part of the thing with the when I was digging into this mud and these, like, little bugs started coming out. They did kind of pick at me.
Yeah.
But it didn't feel like a sting like you would get from a bumblebee. It felt almost like a bite.
Yeah, because they don't have any venom.
So unlike bumblebees, they do not have venom. They do not live in hives that we think of traditionally.
Right.
I was also interested in how they pollinate. They pollinate differently.
Oh, they're such amazing pollinators. I wonder if it has something to do with the wildness of them. I don't know. Honeybees are very elegant, right? They're not quite as hairy. They land on a flower and they go for the nectar. That's what they're going for. It's their business to get the nectar so that they can start turning that into honey and head back to the hive. So they go for the nectar, and they might get pollen on them. If they get pollen on them, sometimes they'll take their spit and squish the pollen back into these little pouches in the back of their legs, right? So they like to kind of keep clean, but they still have pollen on them. Then they go to the next blossom, and some pollen falls off. They're good and efficient pollinators, but mason bees come in, and they're not elegant at all. They're total slobs, and they're fuzzy, so they, like, body slam the flower, and they roll around, and they get covered with pollen. And then they go to the next blossom, and they body slam that one, and they roll around. And so they pollinate 95% of the time, whereas honeybees 5% of the time. That means one mason bee can pollinate as many flowers as 100 honeybees, which is why it's so important to think of these pollinators when it comes to the fear of the colony collapse disorder and the fear of the, you know, if our honeybees die out, they are our main pollinators, but they don't have to be. I mean, we've got better ones in the wings that just don't make honey.
That don't make honey. But are there threats that are facing these mason bees, carpenter bees, the other solitary bees who do pollinate?
Mites are an issue. So in the book, I talk about, you know, adding a new hive and changing things out. Some people actually take the tubes out in the fall and open them up and rinse the cocoons and keep them in the refrigerator. You don't have to do that. You know, pesticides are a real issue, right? The things that you spray on your plants in order to kill bugs, you know, if we think about it, they're killing bugs, but those bugs have the same chemical composition as we do. We're just much bigger. It's still hurting us. So that'll hurt the bees as well. And I also, as there's a section in the book that has different sprays that you can use that are made out of plants that are not going to hurt anybody, but they're going to keep the bugs away from your plants. Like, you know, you use garlic, you know, churned up in a potion of garlic and even a biodegradable soap and water, and it's going to protect your plants from being eaten by anything.
All right. Well, if you want to encourage a mason bee, or even perhaps a bumblebee, or whatever kind of bee you're trying to get, what should you be putting in your garden? What do those bees really like to pollinate, and what kind of amenities do they need?
It's different for every area, right? So whatever wild bee is in the area likes a particular kind of flower that is found in the area, right? So around here, I would say talk to a garden center and find out what the native species are, because they love native species. They even have seed packs that are meant for pollinators. They'll grow flowers that are really good for them. But it's interesting because they don't see the same spectrum as we do. We see red, orange, yellow, blue, green, violet, right? Roy G. Biv. Bees, they slide up a little bit. They don't see reds so much. They will see orange, yellow, blue, green, violet, and ultraviolet. So it slides up. So flowers that look white to us often have these ultraviolet patterns in them that are like, come all, you know, all you can eat, 24-hour dining, you know. So I would say steer up in that color. But all bees need water, but you don't want to put just a bowl of water out there because they could drown in it. So what I've done is I've used the bottom plate of a potted plant, you know, a shallow dish, and you put water in that, but you put marbles and pebbles and maybe even a stick in it so that you kind of give them beachfront property. You give them something they can land on solidly above the water, but that they can make their way to the water and not drown. Mason bees will need that. They also need mud. They need to have damp mud. We have a kind of very clay-like soil in the corner, and so I just made sure I kept that wet through the summer last year, just so that when they needed it, they could get to it. It's amazing how fast the little water dish evaporates, too. You got to fill that up every day.
All right, so if you're looking for bees, water, mud if you're looking for a mason bee, and then
flowers.
This book.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
All right, well, thank you so much for coming in and speaking with me today, Lynn.
Well, thank you for having me.
Lynn Brunell is the author of Turn This Book Into a Beehive, and if you're interested in doing just that, head over to WUWM.com to see our beehive and learn how to make your own. That's all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. Fresh air is next.